It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With a shortage of medical staff trained to conduct sexual assault forensic exams, a new program underway at UW-Milwaukee seeks to train and help retain sexual assault nurse examiners. Call in with questions at any point, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jacqueline Caleri Robinson is a sexual assault nurse examiner certified by the International Association of Forensic Nurses and a UW-Milwaukee College of Nursing doctoral student. Jackie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello, good morning. Thank you. How are you today?
I'm doing well. We also have your colleague, Penina Kako, an associate professor of nursing at UW-Milwaukee and director of its sexual assault nurse examiner training program. Penina, welcome.
Thank you.
Penina, let's start with you. First, help us understand some distinctions here. The State Department of Justice offers a sexual assault nurse examiner certification training program. Why introduce another program through to UW-Milwaukee?
Exactly. We're so fortunate to have this program at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee College of Nursing because it offers a platform whereby nurses can be trained within academia. This program is set up to be offered and trained using sexual assault examiner nurses, experts in this field, as well as partnering with researchers. So we are bringing the best into the curriculum, which is informed by evidence-based practice.
How valuable, Penina, is the timing piece of this education? Why is it important to incorporate this training while a student is in nursing school?
Well, this program is being incorporated within University of Wisconsin College of Nursing. We think and we know that we have students within the College of Nursing who might be interested in taking this route. And having a program within academia is really helpful for sustainability. We are thinking that in that realm, we have undergraduate students, we have graduate students as well. And having this program this way, it can be sustained.
Jackie, your perspective on that from a doctoral student's perspective, when is the right time to offer this training? Because it is intensive and perhaps, you know, a nurse should be in the clinical setting, you know, and seeing patients before they get the certification.
Well, that is what's happening. So we're offering this training to nurses that are already practicing within within nursing. They're coming back to us, and we're offering this training within a platform that allows them to be associated with the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee within the college academic platform of Canvas. So it's an online platform of looking at academic resources. The whole platform has been developed. The curriculum has been developed by PhD professors, and it's actually being utilized and being trained. Nurses that are doing the training are actually practicing forensic nursing. So they've been in practice, these nurses. They're just coming back into academia, into this platform to do this training.
So, Jackie, looking at the numbers, fewer than 50 nurses in Wisconsin have this certification through the International Association of Forensic Nurses. What stands out to you about the significance of this certification?
So there's a couple of things that stand up out for me. First of all, I've been certified through IFN for a very long time, and the test is rigorous. So what we wanted to do is just be able to offer ongoing education for nurses, a mentoring program, offering them, multiple layers of support and ongoing support that the test will not be so difficult to pass. This type of nursing, you have to make a commitment toward lifelong learning. We don't know what we don't know about this type of nursing yet, trauma-informed care specifically, how to best serve survivors of violence. And so you have to make a commitment to lifelong learning. And that's what we're trying to do, create a platform that nurses can return to us. We can mentor them through this process and they can get the resources they need to have the opportunity to sit for these exams, because again, these exams are not easy, and we want to create these opportunities for these nurses.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about these efforts to grow the number of sexual assault nurse examiners certified in Wisconsin. Jackie Kaleri Robinson there and Panina Kako. They're part of this new UW-Milwaukee training program. You can join in with your questions at any point, 800-642-1234. Panina, you say it's a priority for this training to include culturally responsive care. Talk about what that entails, what that means.
Right, exactly. So we find that, you know, people who are Black and Brown, American Indians, LGBTQ populations, usually are in the margins, that they don't really get care. So we have focused this curriculum to train nurses on how to meet the patients or survivors of sexual violence where they are. In the curriculum, we have reached out to advocates, people who are providing care in the community to this population, so that we can integrate them in the curriculum. And so we are having nurses go through the training, thinking about structural racism, individual racism, how does that impact care? And having the nurses learn about that way from the beginning is helping them think through in each module how they can incorporate sexual examiners training, thinking, and having the lens of cultural safety.
Jackie, what comes up for you as you think about this work and being culturally responsive?
So this is about creating opportunities in communities, you know, partnering with every community and offering survivors in every community an opportunity to have access to these specifically trained nurses. And that's not happening in many communities of color. So that's what we want to do. The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee had a grant before this one to specifically provide medical forensic care to indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. So our goal is always to create these opportunities in communities of color to ensure that all survivors of sexual violence have an opportunity to see these specially trained nurses, because we believe these nurses are the best at caring for survivors, listening to survivors, knowing what to do to implement nursing care intervention that will lessen harm to survivors of violence.
Nurses are already in a stressful profession, Jackie, as you know, and there is so much on the line in this aspect of nursing. How are you addressing burnout among trained nurses?
Well, that's something that is incorporated into this program, which is great. And Dr. Kako can speak to this even more thoroughly than I can. But we are incorporating a mentorship program into our curriculum. So the nurses will go through their 50-hour didactic class. Then they will attend a clinical skills lab. And then we will mentor them. And we hope to stay connected with them to offer ongoing training, to connect them with local state nurses, to connect them with the International Nurses Association. We want to ensure both the International Association of Forensic Nursing and the Academy of Forensic Nursing, we want to ensure that these nurses will be supported. Support, guidance, mentoring, doing whatever we can to ensure that these nurses feel like they can have their questions answered, that they can get the information that they need, that they can speak to somebody that has more experience in one community or another, that they can get what they need to continue to do this work.
Panina, what is that next step for you in retention? Jackie mentioned so many pieces of it. What can you add?
Right. So the retention starts right when the students come into the program. We are having students really think through the practice that they're entering into or they are part of. And that includes self-reflection, their journaling, and we are identifying whatever needs that be for those students, that we actually use those, whatever they need to expand the program. For example, we realize that we need to add another layer of support. And as we speak right now, this week, we've added that layer of support whereby we are bringing in an advocate into the curriculum and Jackie also into the curriculum to actually support nurses through. We trust that as nurses feel, you know, supported through this program, that will impact their sustainability. And in the mentoring program, after the initial mentoring, we'll also add another tier layer of sustained peer support or peer mentoring forum where nurses can actually come together either biweekly or once a month, whatever is needed, to continue as they go out now into practice.
Nurse practitioner Penina Kako there directs UW-Milwaukee's Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Training Program that is underway. Jackie Kaleri Robinson is a certified sexual assault nurse examiner, doctoral student at UW-Milwaukee. Call in with your questions, your thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin has fewer than 50 certified sexual assault nurse examiners. At UW-Milwaukee, a federal grant underway is enabling more nurses to receive this specialized training, receive the support systems to work with people who have experienced sexual assault or abuse. Call in with your questions, your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Jackie Kaleri Robinson, a certified sexual assault nurse examiner and a nursing doctoral student at UW-Milwaukee, and Penina Kako, who directs the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Training Program Associate Professor at UW-Milwaukee. Penina, your program receives funding through a federal grant, Federal Department of Health and Human Services, and you have said there is funding for at least two more rounds of classes, one in the fall, another in spring 2024. What does the future hold? Do you plan to secure more funding?
Exactly. So we are very well positioned within the College of Nursing UWM to continue this training. Our hope is that we will seek more funding because we've already had such a high interest. The first cohort, we had to wait list, you know, our students, and we're anticipating another influx of the need, you know, for this program to come in the fall and in the spring. The fact that we are situated within the College of Nursing also provides a platform for us to begin to infuse that training within classes or however that looks like. Already Jackie has given presentations in classes, just using that to heighten the need among the students is helpful. But we are looking forward to having more funding because this is a high need as the public and nurses realize that this is a niche or practice that is so much needed to serve the most vulnerable populations.
Jackie, thinking about that wait list and then putting that up against the International Association of Forensic Nurses saying less than one third of our counties here in Wisconsin have at least one certified sexual assault nurse examiner. What happens in the counties without a nurse?
Well, survivors have to travel, which is a burden. And thank goodness for Wisconsin has a great infrastructure of sexual assault nurse sexual assault advocates that are so on the spot and helpful to survivors of sexual violence. So they are right there ensuring that they get the care that's needed. But survivors needing a medical forensic exam will have to travel. And that's been a burden.
Can you explain a little bit further how much of a burden? It's not just the transportation. What are some of the other things that we might not think about?
Oh, my goodness. If there's major physical trauma, if there's bleeding, if there's head trauma, you know, patients' lives can be at risk. So we certainly need to ensure that we have these kinds of opportunities in every community. So that burden is a traumatic physical burden. That burden is a traumatic psychological burden. That burden is also on the family and friends of those survivors. So we really want to ensure that there is community access in every community in Wisconsin.
Penina, big picture here. The state legislature is in the middle of drafting a state budget for the next 2 years. Wisconsin is expecting a roughly $7 billion surplus. How could the state expand training for sexual assault nurse examiners?
Oh, there's great opportunities supporting programs like this, adding in layers of advocacy. Training among nurses that will be very helpful. We want these trainings to be in the community settings. In the past, we have had, which is wonderful, great practice within healthcare systems. But the more we can bring these trainings within the communities whereby people of color can actually have access with trust, with trusting healthcare professional nurses, will be very helpful. If we can highlight this need, which we know that is increasing, and many people usually do not seek care or even underreport when they experience sexual assault, we can begin to help and support communities that are actually in much need.
So you see this as bringing the training to different communities and not just saying nurses come to Milwaukee at a certain point to do this training.
Exactly. For example, the great idea about our program, what is such a great about it is that it's online, it's didactic. The didactic curriculum is online. Mm-hmm. So we have nurses actually who are in the farthest corners of Wisconsin that provide even care in the areas where there is no care. So they can actually access this training. So we are prepared to be able to train nurses all over within Wisconsin and even beyond. Why? Because they can access that training. We have a platform, Canvas platform, that is very well designed, interactive, and nurses can train. And then they can come and do the clinical skills lab. At the College of Nursing, we have the state-of-the-art skills lab that nurses are able to access. And we're really looking forward to expansion of this program, whichever way that we can continue to train more and more nurses, not only train, but facilitate their certification and then facilitate their being sustained within the practice.
Penina Kako there and Jackie Kaleri Robinson, they're part of the new UW-Milwaukee training program as we look at the future to train up more sexual assault nurse examiners in Wisconsin and complete that certification. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jackie, turning to the state Department of Justice, Democratic Attorney General Josh Call in 2018 campaigned on clearing that statewide backlog of untested sexual assault kits. And here we are 5 years later. Is the state doing a better job, in your estimation, of handling this potential evidence?
The state of Wisconsin is doing an amazing job, a wonderful job. I do want to call attention to the fact that the training of sexual assault nurse examiners has been going on in the great state of Wisconsin since 1993, 1994. The first grants to be funded out of the state of Wisconsin came around 2000. The Office of Justice Assistance then, that is now under OJA right now, Wisconsin OJA, they were the first funding resources for nurses to train nurses. So Wisconsin is doing an amazing job at ensuring that nurses are trained, supporting nurses, getting services out to communities, and now tracking the sexual assault kits. What we wanted to do is ensure that we were accessing all of the nurses that are going through academia, that we were going to ensure every opportunity for nurses to get this training. This training is imperative to ensure nurses understand how to treat survivors of violence through a trauma-informed lens, to not re-traumatize, but to treat survivors with empathy. Mm-hmm. compassion, and patient-centered care.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Penina Kako, Associate Professor of Nursing at UW-Milwaukee, directs its Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Training Program. Jackie Kaleri Robinson is an International Association of Forensic Nurses certified sexual assault nurse examiner and a UW-Milwaukee College of Nursing doctoral student. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum remembering a woman whose life was cut far too short. We share the story in honor of the recent Missing or Murdered Indigenous Persons Awareness Day.
Menominee tribal member Ray Elaine Turtelot was 18 when she went missing on the tribe's reservation during the fall of 1986. Tribal police and the FBI found her remains the following spring. Her daughter, Elise Arce, and relative Andrea Lemke Roshan sat down to talk about Ray with WPR's Daniel Kading. They also shared their hopes for a new task force that's focused on murdered and missing Indigenous women in Wisconsin.
My name is Elise Arce. I'm Ray's daughter.
I'm Andrea Lemke Roshan, and I'm Ray Elaine's cousin and friend. Ray Elaine was pure joy. She and I grew up together. We were kids. She lived on the reservation and I didn't. So I loved whenever we would go visit. She was laughing all the time. She was a huge joker and just a really beautiful girl and a really beautiful young woman. And that beauty radiated really from the inside out.
I just know that she was really outgoing and she had a lot of spirit and a lot of lift. She loved to dance, powwow dance. She was Menominee princess. She was very into our culture, singing and drumming class, Menominee language.
The time we would spend together, she would try to teach me Menominee. She tried to teach me to dance. She told me I was a hopeless dancer. I never quite could do it, but she was a gorgeous dancer. She did fancy dancing, and that's supposed to mimic a butterfly. And Ray Elaine looked like a butterfly embodied when she danced. It was just really beautiful.
And she was very family-oriented.
I hadn't seen Elise in a few years, and I had gone back up for a family gathering at my cousin Ray's sister's house. And Elise and I, Elise, you were a teenager, but we were on a pontoon boat ride together. And Elise threw her head back and laughed. And I thought, oh, my God, there she is. There's Ray. There's Ray Lane right there, right in front of me.
It's nice to hear stuff like that because a part of me feels like she's living through me. She's always around me all the time.
I remember getting a message saying, you need to call home right away. It was in October of 1986. And I called home and my mom was sobbing. She just couldn't even get the words out to tell me that Ray was missing. And I couldn't wrap my head around it because I knew she had just given birth to Elise.
I was only 2 months old when this happened. This was something that kind of shook our whole reservation from what I know, because my aunties kept newspaper clippings and everything from way back then.
We learned that part of her body had been found in a beaver dam on the reservation. So it was very, very hard.
I just don't want any other family to go through what we went through. I see and I know the pain of my family because I can see it in their eyes and how they are.
I think this missing and murdered Indigenous women work is the first time that I feel like there's something tangible that I can do to try to make a difference. We really do want to raise awareness that this is a problem impacting Native women and Native girls, and we need it to stop, and we want it to stop.
It's something that needs to be fixed within the system. And that's why I'm saying, like, I don't want another family dealing with what we are dealing with. I don't want people going off with cold cases for 34 years. I don't want them to have this pain that we carry around with us every day. That's what I want out of this, because, I mean, and I feel like that would be her only justice of this, is to help other families, because nobody should ever have to feel what we felt.
WPR's Danielle Kading brought us that story, remembering Ray Elaine Turtelot, a Menominee tribal member who was killed in 1986. Her family is participating in the new Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now, the dropout early warning system in Wisconsin. It uses machine learning to predict a student's risk of either dropping out of high school or not graduating on time. We explore a recent study that examines this tool and its impact over time. You can join the conversation at any point. Call in with questions at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tolani Britton is an assistant professor of education at the University of California, Berkeley. Tolani, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Good morning. And Juan Perdomo is here, recently received his graduate degree from UC Berkeley's Computer Science Division. Juan, welcome.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Juan, let's start with you. The report shows 2/3 of our schools here in Wisconsin use this early warning system to predict who is at risk of dropping out. What are you learning about the system and its effectiveness?
Yeah, so the system's been in place starting in 2012, and it's used as a way to try to answer this question of, you know, what students in Wisconsin public schools need the most help at a young age. So we can, teachers can intervene and hopefully keep them on track to graduate. And, well, kind of just quickly summarizing, we find that the system hasn't really led to better graduation rates in Wisconsin. So even though it's been quite accurate in predicting who will and who won't graduate, we don't find that it's led to improvements in the graduation rates for schools across the state.
And, you know, from your computer science background, this is an algorithm. How complex is it? How is it working? How is the system working, you know, in the background here?
So the algorithm's quite sophisticated, and I guess, but it's pretty common as far as machine learning algorithms go. This is something that there's publicly available code that anyone can use to do similar things, but essentially just tries to identify patterns in the data. So it looks at historical patterns of students and their graduation outcomes in Wisconsin and tries to mine these patterns to predict, you know, for future students who will graduate and who will not.
So, Tolani, once schools receive the warnings from this system that students are at high risk of not graduating, what are schools typically doing with this information? How are they responding?
Thank you for the question, Kate. I think it's pretty complex. On the one hand, you're receiving information, and many times I would think that school counselors or administrators who are looking at this data, receiving this data. On the other hand, the reasons that students aren't graduating are quite complex. Many of them have to do with things like student attendance, student academic performance, and structural barriers. When we think about public education today within the state of Wisconsin and really nationally, there's a shortage of certified teachers. There are high rates of mental health struggles, both with students and teachers. And so I think that schools are getting information that in some ways they might have already, which students are struggling. But the question that I think that we should be talking a little bit more about is how can we use things like these algorithms to help schools understand where they should be intervening, not necessarily just with whom they should be intervening.
Okay, so it's the piece about deploying adequate interventions that is not holding up here. Basically, the system is a predictor, but it kind of stops at that point. It's not like the other piece of it is intervention.
Absolutely. The other piece is intervention. And I think the intervention piece is the more complex piece in some ways. I think understanding who the students are is extremely important. So I don't want to ignore that piece of the puzzle. But I do think that because students are individual, their circumstances are individual, and at the same time, they're living within these structures, both schools, communities, states, understanding what works for a given student in a given context is really some of the information that schools need in order to move the needle around high school completion, college enrollment, et cetera.
I want to get your reaction to the report from The Markup, the nonprofit news organization, looking more deeply at this algorithm and saying that, you know, look, including race and family income in the system is further marginalizing and stigmatizing students. What is your reaction, Talani?
Yeah, so I'm of two minds, and I definitely want to hear what Juan has to say on this one, particularly because he works with the algorithms. I think that understanding the ways in which a student's racial background and their socioeconomic status, the relationship between that and their outcomes is important. I think that we are all clear, or maybe I'm making some assumptions, I am clear, that the realities of race and social economic status are absolutely one of the determinants of students' outcomes, both short-term and long-term. And so we're thinking about the likelihood of having access to high-quality schools, the likelihood of being in neighborhoods where nutritious and fresh food is available, the likelihood of having resources to attend college or attend colleges where graduation rates are high. So I think that including it is not necessarily the problem. I think the issue becomes problematic when we don't simply include it, but we use it as a reason not to do additional interventions, or simply to say, well, this is socioeconomically determined, so I can't do very much about it. I think that's when it becomes problematic.
Juan, what are your insights on these input variables with demographic data?
Yeah, I completely agree with Talani. So on the one hand, things like race and income are related to lots of other factors that do determine whether students will graduate from high school on time. And I think that given these strong relationships, I think it's important to use these kinds of statistics because they actually do carry a lot of information regarding, you know, answering this question of like which students need the most help. If there are, which there are, big disparities in achievement or graduation rates between different demographic groups, you know, it's important.
Which there are in Wisconsin,
There are in Wisconsin. This isn't something that's very important to know, and the only way to know this is by tracking that kind of information. I think this is kind of closer to Lonnie's point at the end is, you know, it's one thing to put this into the algorithm. What you do based off interventions is kind of a separate question. But no, I don't think it's inherently problematic to include it for the sake of prediction.
Juan Perdomo there, computer scientist, Talani Britton, assistant professor of education, both from the University of California, Berkeley, their recent study on how Wisconsin schools label high-risk students and identify how to target extra support. Call in with your question on the dropout early detection system, your thoughts, how they work, what you wonder, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with UC Berkeley researchers on their study called Difficult Lessons on Social Prediction from Wisconsin Public Schools. Looks at the complexities of machine learning to identify struggling students. Join the conversation. Call in with your question at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tolani Britton is an assistant professor of education. Juan Perdomo is a computer scientist. You know, I want to, one line that jumps out in your study, Tolani, is to think of an early warning system as a sorting procedure. And indeed, a common goal of machine learning is to improve efficiency. So with that said, how can machine learning be improved, you know, be reformed to, you know, be more efficient, to be more effective?
Yeah, Kate, I think that's a really great question, and I'll probably give you a partial answer to that really good question. We spoke a little bit earlier in the show about what information machine learning might provide that schools do not have. As a former classroom teacher in New York City, I could probably relatively accurately identify which of my students were struggling. What I really needed assistance or help with, and I think this may be a place where algorithms might be helpful because they have the capacity to sort of look across a wide swath of data and return relatively accurate predictions, is what actually worked with respect to improving student outcomes. Is it that for students who had a hard time with attendance, for example, they needed to be placed in classes that started later in the day, right? Was that an effective algorithm, or was that an effective way to sort students? For students who needed extra help, was having a push-in teacher in the classroom more effective, or having additional time after school? There are all of these interventions. And in some ways, what is hard to understand or predict for an individual teacher with an individual student, there might be data sort of over time within a school, is what actually helps students become more successful. And it really is our sort of collective responsibility when we think about how much of this is structurally determined, right? Mm-hmm. The type of school that you attend, proportion of teachers who are credentialed, who are absolutely working hard, whether or not they're credentialed, but may not have as much experience.
Juan, your insights there, because, you know, Tolani bringing up all the structural determinants that do have such an impact. How can machine learning, be effective in efficiency, but also more effective in the outcomes?
Yeah, so I think that the DPI has built like quite an impressive system for the sake of prediction. Hmm. Like it uses a lot of information around students, and it has like a big database of, you know, historically which students in Wisconsin graduate and which students in Wisconsin don't. And because they have so much data, you can generate like a very accurate predictor that will tell you who will graduate and who will not. What it does not have is what Tolani is hinting at, which is like a different system that doesn't just tell you who will graduate and who will not, but will actually suggest possible interventions that will effectively change outcomes. I think that not just in Wisconsin, but across the nation, there isn't quite such a holistic database to try to systematically understand which kinds of interventions and strategies work with different kinds of students. And if we had access to such a data set, then we could start thinking about different algorithms and insights that we could use from this data to improve educational trajectories.
And one thing that comes out of the report, Tolani, is to improve graduation rates by, looking at the school level, which I think is where you were headed, focus on schools rather than individual students. Why would that focus be helpful?
Yeah, Kate, so I want to both answer that question, return a little bit to your prior question, I think, you know, part of what Juan was suggesting, I think we're both suggesting, is really thinking about using this in some way, some of the same data to understand or better think about interventions for student outcomes. And sort of in my dream world, what that might look like is actually using the same data, looking at students who potentially were at risk but graduated, and thinking what actually worked for these students. So looking at some of these same factors and which are the ones that seem to have been associated with maybe a higher likelihood of you know, for example, completing high school, given that this student was at risk, might be another way to look at this data, not just using the data to think about, okay, who is at risk, but for those who are at risk who graduated, what were some of the factors actually associated with that positive outcome? Hmm. Okay.
Who broke the system in his head? Carry on, Talani. Yes.
No, and so then the second part of your question, I'm just going to reflect that back to you, was really, before I answer it, to make sure I sort of captured it, was really trying to think a little bit more about school level factors. Is that correct?
Yes, because, you know, I think the line in the report was that, you know, you can figure this out by just focusing on the schools, the low income schools that really need the help.
Absolutely. I think that that is the case. What I don't want to suggest is that schools can solve societal ills. I think in many ways that misses the mark. But I do think schools absolutely have a role. And it's not simply about giving schools resources. It's about giving them things like, you know, additional teacher training, genuinely ensuring that students have access to nutritious food. When I worked in New York City, we had a relatively small school, fewer than 400 students in a high school, and two trained counselors, licensed social workers. So I think that it's not just, as I said, resources, but the kinds of resources, and having a way to actually have those resources be, you know, shift from year to year. So, you know, it's one thing to give a school money and say you can only, you know, do an after school program with this. Well, it could be that they need an after school program in year one, but in year two, what they need is an additional mental health counselor because of some of the impacts of the pandemic or some other crises. So I think that it's one, giving resources to schools, but also really speaking to students, to parents, to teachers, to administrators in a school to understand what those needs are, and having the capacity to be somewhat agile with respect to the ways in which the needs for those resources might change over time.
Talani and Juan, thank you for joining us and sharing your research on Wisconsin.
Of course. Thank you so much for having us.
Juan Perdomo and Talani Britton, they're researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, co-authors of the study called Difficult Lessons on Social Prediction from Wisconsin Public Schools. Find a link to the study at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.